response?
Much of, and this is a rich discussion, and I hope that it continues. We've, as you may have heard, we have quite a few conversations happening on the side, but we do need to move on to the next one. Thank you, Chris. We're going to now go to Senator Howard Stevenson, who is going to talk about a bill he's running, the Anti-Voucher Student Opportunity Scholarship. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you. A lot of people have said when I sponsored, began to talk about this legislation, but that's just a voucher all over. The people have rejected that. And, of course, the voters did repeal our voucher law. We had a universal voucher, the most widespread in the nation. And those who are opposed to it, the teachers' union and others, they put a lot of money in this state from the National Education Association saying, do you want your tax dollars going to send rich kids to private schools? And, of course, the voters, hearing all that advertising, rejected vouchers. During that debate, one of the biggest arguments, effective arguments, and actually a somewhat legitimate argument that the opponents used was, you know, this will tend to take some of the brightest kids from the public schools, some of the most kids with the most wealthy families from the public schools, leaving the school teachers was some of the hardest to teach. And in fact, when I go around and visit classrooms, I often ask teachers, what is your most big, what is your biggest challenge in a classroom? And they almost always say that one of their biggest challenges is the two or three very difficult students, whether through discipline, I was one of those, or through scoring on tests. You're waiting for me to say I was one of those too, aren't you? And they say, if I didn't have to deal with just those two or three who take 50-plus percent of my time and energy, I could really focus on the rest of the 24 in my classroom. And so this bill is focused solely on those lowest three or four kids in the class to say, if their parents want to add money and take a scholarship for that student to go elsewhere, they should be able to do that, easing the burden of that classroom teacher. Right now, there are not a lot of private schools that accept students who are below grade level. There are some private schools who won't take your child if they're not at grade level. But there are several who will. And in fact, as I've talked to the people in the Catholic schools in Utah, they say, we want those low-performing students. We want those ELL students who are really hard for a teacher to teach. Because we can, with our resources and with our approach, teach them effectively. The other thing this will do is help to create a market so that there will be new private schools created. Just in brief, let me describe the program. There will be a tax credit allowable, which you as a business or an individual can, if you donate to a scholarship granting organization, a 501c3, you will get 100% tax credit toward that contribution with certain limits. That scholarship granting organization then will take applications from parents whose children qualify for those scholarships, and they will grant the scholarships, and they usually require the parent or others to pay for part of that so that there's skin in the game from the family itself. It's a win-win situation. It takes those difficult-to-teach kids out of the school system at their parents' request with the scholarship granting organization. A lot of people said, weren't you going to wait 10 or so years before we bring back school choice because the voters rejected it? With the Arizona tuition tax credit being granted and then defended all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, when the U.S. Supreme Court decided earlier this year that it was okay to give public money for these types of vouchers, scholarships, even though they would go to a religious organization. That was the general basis for the argument against it. The U.S. Supreme Court voted that that would be allowed, and that's why we have generated this bill this year myself and several other legislators who are pushing it. We believe that it's the right thing to do, it's the right time, and we ought to give these lowest performing students what they need in education, because right now they're falling between the cracks in our traditional classrooms. Just one thing about the name of it. The Anti-Boucher Student Opportunity Scholarship. I think that has a ring to it. And it hopefully debunks the people who say, oh, this is just vouchers all over again. But we've also been thinking of calling it something else. As you may know, we have a special needs scholarship that's been in place in Utah for some time. It was named after one of the students who really needed that scholarship, Carson Smith. So we're thinking of calling this Carson Smith 2.0, because these are not necessarily kids with an IEP or special needs students. These are the next tier up in our school system, those who are really falling between the cracks. So I'd be interested in your opinion. In fact, why don't we do a straw poll right now? We're going to ask whether you want Anti-Boucher Student Opportunity Scholarship or the Carson Smith 2.0 Student Opportunity Scholarship. Okay, who thinks the Anti-Boucher should be the name we put on the bill? Okay. Who thinks Carson Smith 2.0 is what we should put on the bill? Well, we're kind of evenly divided, so we're going to have to grapple with that. Thank you.
Oh, just one question.
Sure.
Is there a teachers union opposition to this?
Yes, there will be. There is teachers union opposition to it already. So,
State Office of Education, the Utah School Board Association, any coalition behind you on this at all?
They are not behind it. They are not supportive.
How would this be funded? Would this take away from the schools? Would the children leave? Is it all donations?
It would take income tax credits that would be given, which otherwise would have gone into the public school system. But they won't be in the amount that is currently being spent on that student. So the system will actually have more money to spend for the students who remain. So it should be an actual positive fiscal note. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, we have lots of entertaining topics. Speakers never like this, but my experience is that the audience likes to go on and go quickly rather than have us drone on. Our next speaker will be Senator Margaret Dayton, who will be speaking about College and Career Readiness Assessments, Senate Bill 10, that she is sponsoring.
Thank you, Royce. Thanks to Royce and the Utah Taxpayers Association. Is this on, Royce? Can you hear me back there? Is that better? Oh, good. Thanks to Royce and the Utah Taxpayers Association for putting this on and inviting me to speak. I'm sorry Howard has stepped out for a minute because I could solve his dilemma on what to name his anti-voucher bill or his Carson Smith 2.0 whatever. Why don't we just call it a Student Opportunity Scholarship and refer to it as SOS? It sounds like a good idea that someone in the back suggested to me. I'm glad to promote that. I'm also speaking on an education bill. About 6 or 8 years ago, I opened a bill file suggesting that we use the ACT test as an evaluation tool for our high school students to see how they were preparing themselves for graduation and for college and how that compared with the rest of the nation. It seemed like such a good idea to me, inasmuch as the state was spending so much money writing their own evaluation tools. I proposed that bill and was not successful in overcoming the resistance from the education community. The state board and the state office said that ACT does not allow that and they couldn't afford it even if they did, and there was a lot of resistance to it. So it was an interesting experience for me a couple of months ago when former state senator Dave Thomas, who is also a current state school board member, came to me and asked me if I would consider running a bill that the state school board unanimously supported, having the ACT as an evaluation tool for high school students. It would replace the UBISCET testing, which is Utah Basic Skills Competency testing tool that has been created specifically for the state. It would replace that. It would have all the students in the 10th grade taking this test with some preparatory information testing done in the 8th grade. It has some multiple positive effects, obviously helping the kids in the 10th grade realize how well they would do if they were planning to participate in the ACT later to go to college. Maybe those who didn't think they were college material or could not compete would take it in the 10th grade and do so much better than they expected and realize that they are. Or maybe some who are planning to go on to college would then have some idea of what their weaknesses were and what they needed to do for those last couple of years in high school to make them most effective and to get their skills improved to score better on a repeat ACT testing. That is the effect of the bill. It passed out of the Education Interim Committee, and then the next month when I wasn't in the committee, Senator Stevenson, with my approval, amended the bill to include another test, and I'm apologizing that I can't remember the entire name for the acronym, but it's a military test. It's a battery of tests that is geared for students who anticipate having post-high school education but not necessarily college degrees. It's a free test that's available and offered to the states. So that has been amended into the bill as an option for the high school students to have the military battery of tests and or the other. The decision on when those tests will be given in the schools is still going to be a state board rule. And one of the concerns about having this military test as an option for all students, which seems logical to me, is that with the cutback in military funding, that might be one of the places where the military cuts back and not providing this as a free test. But the advantage, of course, is that the state of Utah is going to be providing testing for the high school students to see how they are prepared for graduation and for college readiness in the state and with other students in other states, since so many states use this test. Now, one of the good, exciting things about this bill, now that it's passed out of interim, it's since gone to have a fiscal note, and the bill asks for a $2.2 million appropriation to pay for these ACT tests for the students to take them. Imagine my delight as a legislator and a taxpayer when the fiscal analyst said, well, since we won't be using the UBISCIP testing, which the state office has funding for, we can use that money to apply to the ACT, so the $2.2 million requested in the bill will be reduced to $700,000. Anyway, we can save money, which always makes us happy. So that is where the bill is right now. It's anticipated that since it's had a couple of committee hearings, it will be heard, it'll go straight to the Senate floor this next week and be heard in the Senate and then proceed on to the House. Questions on that issue? Thank you. I'm glad that mine is not one of the hot question topics. But if you have concerns, let me know because we will be discussing this for debate, and I'd be glad to work with you on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Again, we are juggling the agenda as inevitably happens. We thought everything was nice and neat, but travel being what it is. We're going to next go to Representative Wayne Harper and Mark Griffin. From Overstock.com, Representative Harper is going to be talking about sales and use tax nexus and notification, and Mark Griffin will talk about some of the concerns that he and other online retailers have with that proposal. So if we could, Representative Harper, if you could start with 5 minutes, and then if we could get 5 minutes from you after that, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate being here today. As you know, the state of Utah for the last 11 years has been involved with the streamlined sales tax implementing states. We shifted over in 2008 to the governing board and are very active in that. I don't know whether it's good or not, but next year I will be the president of the streamlined sales tax governing board, so a lot of the things that will be happening you can, you know, talk to me about, and hopefully I can give you a correct answer. If not, somebody from the tax commission will straighten me out, which they're very good at doing. Anyway, over the years, we've been trying to facilitate and help residents of the state of Utah to comply with existing state law. We have what is called the Sales and Use Tax Act. It's been on the books for over 80 years. And basically, if you buy something within the state, you pay the sales tax. If you buy something, and this was traditionally set up for mail order catalogs back in the 1930s, and it's expanded out, and it's the same rule now that if you do a phone order or an internet, you're obligated under current state law to pay a use tax. And that use tax is filled out on your income tax report, income tax return, which clearly states how much out-of-state purchases you make that are subject to sales tax sales tax needs to be collected. Two bills that I am running this year, one is a notification, one is a nexus bill that does nothing more than assist people with the ability to go through and to remit the tax that is already due. The notification bill simply states that an online retailer or a phone or catalog or something as they're doing the order needs to notify the person in the state of Utah if the end sale is in the state of Utah and is non-exempt purchase that you have an obligation to fill out a use tax return. So it gives the company the ability to go through or the requirement to go through and to give notice to people that they have the tax due. The Nexus bill has a little bit different bend. It simply states that if you have a physical presence in the state of Utah, you have affiliated parties or different people that come through and purchase from you or sell through you, that you need to collect the sales tax there. That is if you have a physical presence in the state of Utah. Classic example is Cabela's. Cabela's has a store in Lehigh. They have kiosks within their store where you can go through and purchase goods from their affiliates or their third-party people. So if you have physical presence like that, you need to collect the sales tax. You can't go through and tell the individual that they're exempt. You have to follow the current laws of the state of Utah. What we're trying to do is, again, help people to comply with the law and make it easier for them to know what's there and to do what they're already supposed to do. A lot of people come up to me and say, I just don't know how to go through and deal with the tax issues. I didn't know that purchase was taxable. What do I do now? This is just giving them the notice of how they can do it and the collection ability for people within the state of Utah. That's what the two bills are doing, so come on over.
Oh. Sorry, this is my child's cash register that's making all this noise. I brought some visual aids. Our tax collection system was designed for a footprint tax collection. In other words, I live in Cottonwood Heights. If I come to Salt Lake City and I buy something, I'm taxed there where the cash register is. It's very easy for local businesses to figure out what the tax is. Our problem with all 50 states, not just Utah, engaging in efforts to figure out how to have internet companies collect tax, which is a change in the law, which has existed for 20 years, and we have designed our business around that framework, is that it's very difficult for an internet company to figure out what the local tax is. Now, where do you tax? Where do you go to figure out the tax? At a cash register, it's very easy. It's where the cash register is located. But these are mobile devices. People can order from all over the country. The easiest way, I suppose, for a legislator to think about it, of course, and with all due respect, sometimes it's more complex from our point of view when we actually have to implement it, is to figure out which among the 10,000 taxing districts in this country we have to apply. It doesn't go by zip code. Everything on the internet is done by zip code. You overlay that with the complexity also that each state has a different categorization for items that it wants to collect tax on. Sometimes a candy bar is a candy bar is a candy bar. And they tax that with an obesity tax in some areas. But some states are agricultural states, and if that candy bar has some wheat in it, it's not a candy bar. Add to that the fact that many states have tax holidays, back to school clothing for children, shoes and other school accessories are not taxed at a certain time of year. If we have to collect that tax, we have to keep track of all these different things. So it is multiple layers of the onion. Let me give you an example. We have thought to open up a warehouse in another jurisdiction where we would have to have boots on the ground. In other words, we would have a footprint and have a nexus with that state. We went to implement a taxing system for that state. The software implementation cost us over $350,000 and probably 2 months of a team of programmers of time to get it to interface. When we pass these laws, we don't think about implementation, but that's what's involved. That's why we oppose these state piecemeal legislative pieces, which are coming more rapidly. Now, this proposed legislation proposes two things, and I haven't seen a copy of it, so I apologize if I misstated, but it requires a notice provision to people who are purchasing over the internet of their tax obligations. Well, here's the problem with that. It requires it to be in the flow of the transaction leading up to the sale. Sometimes they do it on the invoice coming back. Let me say why there are two problems with that on the internet. Anything that steps in between the customer looking at a product and making a purchase decision destroys what we call conversion. There is a definite cost to that. If people have to entertain information, they are less likely to purchase. And the more information they have to entertain, the less likely that they are to purchase. So putting something on the transactional documents that says, oh, by the way, you're a Utah resident and there is a tax obligation, is going to kill that sale. If you do it on the invoice, and bear in mind, Utah's not the only state that wants to do this. These may be 50 state tax notices. So putting it on the invoice also has a cost to us, which may be actually greater than the cost of the tax that we are going to collect, and that is we may get customer service calls. And customer service calls at our business here in Utah cost us, on the average, $5 each. So there is a definite cost associated with this. We would like to see the complexity of which I have referenced, minimized. We would like to see a federal solution to this problem. This difference between a cash register-based system and trying to shoehorn in the internet into that system is simply not going to work. We are going to have a piecemeal approach if we don't have a federal solution. We have some ideas, and we're engaging on the federal level about how states might do that. We also wanted to point out that many of these nexus bills, like the one that Representative Harper used with Cabela's, also include a component that if you are a remote seller and you employ a service employee, third-party contractor, you just say, we're selling a pool table, will you go out and level it? Or someone wants a video screen holder on their wall, will you go and install it? If we contract for those services and make that service available to the customer, then these laws try to implicate an obligation to collect tax on that. What does that result in? It's a clear business decision. You don't provide those services. What does that result in? People in Utah are put out of work. So we would say that this solution, a state-by-state solution to the problem, is not good. We would like to see the complexity reduced, and we would like to see some accommodation made for the differences between cash register systems of tax collection and the internet. Thank you. Happy to take any questions.
Do we have any questions?
All right. Thank you. I expect to be more questions from the session, but not necessarily here.
Oh, I think there'll be
one or two. The next section we might call the Pennsylvania presentation. It's a small coincidence, but Pennsylvania and Utah politics happen to be very closely knit. In addition to having Senator Hatch being originally from Pennsylvania. I grew up in Pennsylvania. Representative Greg Hughes grew up. In fact, my high school used to play his high school in volleyball back in the day. And the speaker that he will introduce, Nick Trombetta, who I think it's important to understand as we talk about all of these different policies in a very theoretical way. We need to understand that this happens to real people. And Dr. Trombetta is going to talk to us specifically about the real consequences of what charter schools can do in the lives of families and taxpayers.
Thank you. I want to introduce my friend Nick. Actually, I could spend more time introducing him than he's going to spend talking to you. Our time is brief. But let me just say, in my time in dealing with public policy, and particularly public education, I've come to this unfortunate conclusion that much of it revolves around turf wars. It revolves around an incredible amount of money, and if you take property taxes, state funds, all that we spend here in the state of Utah, it's about $3 billion a year. And what you have is you have, in many ways, adults that fight over adult systems. I want to introduce to you someone who came to the education reform arena in a very different way. Nick Trombetta was a principal. He was a teacher, a principal, a wrestling coach of a small steel town called Midland. Midland is right outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In fact, it's one of the only a few cities, I think three, Gary, Indiana, Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, and Midland, that U.S. Steel actually created the city. They went and put a mill right on the river and went and did executive row of the executives that would live across the street from the mill, created the town. In 1986, when that mill in Midland shut down, that their property tax disappeared, their incomes disappeared, that city and their little main street had no economy whatsoever. And they literally, within a very short amount of time, had to close their school. And in Pennsylvania, it's very different. The school districts are actually, the high school is the feeder school, and then it feeds down from your middle schools and your elementaries, and that represents a district. This district was decimated. These students that lived in this town, there wasn't a district in Pennsylvania that wanted them. They didn't want the cost. They didn't want the busing. They did not want these students. And in fact, the state of Pennsylvania allowed, and they created an agreement, an interstate agreement, where these students were being shipped to Ohio because nobody wanted these kids. Nick Trombetta would still, I mean, he was attached to these kids. He would have these kids when they were training for wrestling. He would purposely have them run down the main street so that those residents and those people in the town saw those kids and knew those kids were in this town and they needed to do something. Well, Governor Tom Ridge passed legislation that allowed for charter schools. Nick Trombetta, seeing these kids shipped everywhere, and by the way, Ohio wasn't their only stop. They were sent from district to district. And what would happen? You have these kids in Midland that become valedictorian, they become the dominant athletes on a team, and guess what? Parents start complaining and they start moving those kids to other districts again. Charter school legislation was passed, and with $0 and with 25 students to begin with in that little town, he began trying and attempting to deliver education to students. Now, Nick's a Democrat, okay? I don't even know how he came to this issue. It's so intuitive for smart Republicans. How did Democrats ever come to this? But Nick started at zero. In fact, the school district sued. They said, we don't want it, because the way they did it there is that if you came from a district, you had that district would pay 70% of this funding for that student to the charter school. And they put that into court. His vendors and those that he had made arrangements with to provide education to these students were not being paid because the districts weren't seeing that money through. It went through court. It worked. The system worked there. Today, they have 40,000 students in 20 states that Dr. Trombetta, through online education, is delivering education to students and improving their lives. They have 11,000 students in the state of Pennsylvania. There are 500 school districts, and it was 499 last time I checked. I don't know if you're at 500 yet. But 499 of the school districts in Pennsylvania have students that receive their education through online curriculum. My point here today, and what I want him, and I actually want him to tell his story, is that he came up against great opposition when talking about the turf, when talking about how you deliver education to kids. And unfortunately, as I said in the beginning, the turf and who gets to control those dollars. I want you to meet someone who I feel has really, he didn't get in this for any other reason than for those children in that town. And it has allowed him a vehicle that he's been able to provide this education. And frankly, I'd like to see that model explored even more in the state. Now, I think Dr. Trombetta will go into some of the criticisms, traditional criticisms of online education and things like that, and he'll address those, but he'll do a better job tonight. Nick Trombetta, thank you.
Good morning, and thank you for this time, and it's very much an honor for me to be here to speak to you about and tell you our story. I want you to know that I am the son of Italian immigrants who came to this country shortly after World War II in search of the American dream. My dad worked in a steel mill, and very proud of his work in that steel mill. And he would come home, and from the various injuries that he would receive working in a dangerous place, he would show me his son, and he would tell me the story. He would show me the shrapnel that might be there from the flying steel or the wound that he may have incurred from a bumper here or there. And he said to me this. He says, "You see this? Do you want this? Because if you don't want this and you don't want this life, then you need to get an education." That was the world I lived in. He taught me that in this country, that education is a great equalizer. He taught me that a good education was the American ticket to the American promise. He made me a believer of that, and it has stayed with me. And it is with that memory, and it was with that background that I got into this world of school reform. I learned something many years later that there's not much equal in public education. Your zip code in this country really can determine the quality and the accessibility and the availability of serious services. So where you live matters, and where you can afford to live matters. I happen to live in an area that lost its manufacturing base in the 80s. And we lost an entire way of life. And we lost the funds that would provide those educational programs to our children. And when we lost them, and we went to our neighbors to ask them for our help, they said no. And as the representative stated, we had to go to another state and buy services from them. It was with that that I approached then our governor, Tom Ridge, who I'm a huge fan of, and still am a big fan of. And he said, "Nick, I'm going to introduce legislation." This is in 1997. "I'm going to give you a planning grant of $25,000. Take this money and see what you can do for your children." And so we began to discuss ways. So we decided that charter schools were the way for our kids to go. Little did we know that that school, that $25,000 planning grant that was to educate just 25 kids, would attract the attention of the world. Suddenly, we were in the Wall Street Journal. Suddenly, we were in the front page of the New York Times. Suddenly, people from across the nation knew of our story and began to show up in our little steel town on the river, along the Ohio River. And I guess people began to say, "Can you replicate what you've done here for our children?" We went to 25. That first year, we had 525. Next year, we went to 1,000. We were at 11,000 there, but I want to share something that I don't know if I shared with you before, Greg, is that in our fourth year, Rick Santorum enrolled his kids in our school. And when people heard that Santorum enrolled his kids in our school, what's good enough for Santorum's kids, it's good enough for ours kids, and our enrollment went from 2,000 to 4,000, 4,000 to 8,000. Kids from all over Pennsylvania, and then eventually across this country. We're fortunate we have friends here, and we're going to be working with them. But we have pretty much dedicated our lives to finding kids that want an education, need an education, whether it's online or in a traditional brick-and-mortar setting. And we support them. Yesterday I had the honor, coming in from New Mexico, we have a school in a pueblo in New Mexico in an adobe building. And I got to meet with the tribal council there. And our students there are the highest performing students in that area. And we're excited. We have a school in South Carolina in what's called the Corridor of Shame, where they spend about $3,500 per student. And we support them. we're in, as Greg said, we're in 20 different states. I do want to tell you this. I'm a proponent of school choice, and it is a bipartisan issue, and it must receive bipartisan support, and it is. It's one of the few things that both sides agree on, that the status quo can't continue, that we need to look at other ways, that when you empower, when you inject a free market into public schools, which has had a monopoly, good things happen to public schools, all public schools. When you give parents the power of choice that will decide where their children will be educated and the quality of that, that's also equally important. I will tell you this, that in our state 10 years ago, under a Democratic governor, Governor Rendell, we saw an increase in charter schools. It went through the roof. And it was our legislature was split with these and ours. But together they enabled more schools to be created. The opponents of that movement said three things would happen. And I think this is what you wanted me to share. Three things would happen. First, they said this will adversely affect public education and test scores will plummet. Secondly, they said that you will dry up. Secondly, they said that teachers will lose their jobs. And thirdly, they said that you will dry up all our cash. You'll just take money away. Well, the interesting thing is that during that time and under Governor Rendell's administration, three things happened. First, test scores went through the roof for all public schools. They went up. In fact, to the level that they increased that no other state during his administration can say that they increased at that amount. Secondly, there are more teachers teaching in Pennsylvania now than there were 10 years ago, even though we have fewer students, which needs to be looked at, I guess. And third, we had record surpluses in dollars. We had record surpluses in dollars. So you'll hear that. You'll hear the opponents say that. I want to thank you. We're excited to be part of this. And good luck to you, Greg, and all the work. Good work that you're doing. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Our next discussion goes to a long problem that has existed between on the funding of charter schools and the students that leave them. At what point should the dollars actually follow the student? Should we be paying the school districts for students that have exited that to enter a charter school? We're going to have one of the local operators of charter schools, Sheldon Kilpak, speak to that point.
My name is Sheldon Kilpak. I work with a company called Academica West, and we do business management for charter schools really up and down the Wasatch Front. We also, my business partner and I work with a few charter schools out of state as well. And in Utah, in terms of how charter schools are funded, I'll just give kind of a brief overview if people aren't familiar with it. You have your income tax, which really goes towards the operations of public schools, and then your property tax, which really has been slated to go towards facilities of public schools. And so when charter schools were created, the question was, the WPU funding, which is basically for the operations that come from income tax, is easy to figure out. We'll just divide that among the number of students or within the public education system, of which public charter schools are public schools. But how do you make up for the property tax issue when students leave a charter school and come into it, the charter school? Well, back when charter schools were founded, I think the easiest solution, rather than deal with the battle of taking money from the school districts of the property tax and having that money follow the child, the legislature decided that they would just fund what they call local replacement funding. And so what otherwise would have followed the child from property tax, the legislature has funded. Well, there's kind of a parity issue, and it's not just for charter schools. It's really even for public schools. And so if you are a school district now that doesn't have a lot of charter schools, that money comes off the top of public education funding. And so before they figure out what the WPU is going to be, the weighted pupil unit funding for each student for operations, this money comes off the top that they now use to fund the in lieu of funding for property taxes, so for charter schools to have facilities. So if I'm a school district now that doesn't have a lot of charter schools, I'm actually taking a greater hit than some of the school districts that have a lot of charter schools. And a few years ago, the legislature decided to take at least 25% of the property tax and help offset the cost from the state. was met with some resistance, but it works. But at this point, the state still contributes over $70 million to the in-lieu of funding. Representative Newbold has a bill, House Bill 313, that would basically be a 13-year phase-in. So starting next year, all the kindergartners, basically, that are within the system, their funding would then, all their property tax funding would go into this general pot for charter schools to then be divided out. The next year would be kindergarten and first grade. Well, to help offset that, really, even from public schools, keep in mind that there's $71 million, roughly, that has currently happened to offset that is now available. And where will that go to? The WPU funding. And so it's not as though they're just going to be a complete loss, but what it allows the state to do is get out of the business of funding the property tax, and the money truly can follow the child. Now, one of the benefits we see within the charter system is that there are no, you have a lot of flexibility with the funding you receive. So you can choose, do I want to put it into facilities, or do I want to put it into operations? And for the teachers, you have all that flexibility of all the funds that come in. Currently, how it exists within regular public schools is you receive your WPU funding, and you have some restrictions on the money that comes in for the property tax. Frankly, I think that even those silos should be taken out. Let them have the flexibility of deciding where to put those funds. And frankly, I'll be honest, I'm a little surprised there hasn't been more push from the regular public education system to see that done, because it would give districts a lot more flexibility in terms of funding their teachers, their administrators versus buildings. If they feel that their building needs are adequate, or that maybe they could even plan a little bit differently for their facilities and utilize the funding for the operations, I'm a big believer that if it works for the charter schools, allow them the same opportunity. One shouldn't really have an advantage over the other. And truly, I think what this bill is it allows the parity of opportunity for both the districts and the charter schools. And in essence, it allows that funding to follow the child. And that's what 313 is aimed to do. This has been a discussion that's been going on for a long time in the legislature. And hopefully this is a year where we can get it resolved. And I think what it will do is really allow the charter system to operate without having to come up to the state every year and ask for additional funding. And for those districts who don't have a lot of charter schools, frankly, it will end kind of the times that they've been disadvantaged by a lot of those monies coming off the top and going to the large districts that have a lot of charter schools. That, in essence, is what this bill is aimed to do.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? All right.
Our next speaker will be Representative Jim Nielsen, who's going to be talking about what I expect to be one of the more controversial bills up here, because he's talking about fundamentally, you know, taking about $48 million out of the general fund, which should be going into the state's trust lands fund. Not trust lands fund, but the permanent state trust fund, and securing it there for our future generations. You take $50 million out of the general fund, people get concerned.
Roy stole my thunder, so I won't have anything to say. No, you know, throughout most of the 20th century, a small island nation called Kiribati mined guano, the droppings of seabirds, for fertilizer. Their economy was based on that. 1956, that country decided to establish a trust fund to save the government revenues that came from this economic activity for the future, when they knew that this activity would end. And in 1979, Kiribati mined its last guano and now gets by barely without that. Now, the trust fund that they built still today has $400 million in it. This is a tiny Pacific Island nation. And the earnings from that fund represent anywhere, depending on how the economy is doing, somewhere from 10% up to a sixth of their entire GDP. This was the case where people looked at a resource, knew that it was limited, and decided to think about the future. We, as has been made public, and as I've written in the Deseret News, and other articles have been written, there are two bills that have my name on them. One is an HJR 6, a joint resolution, which will become, if it's passed by the legislature, will become a ballot question for a constitutional amendment. And associated with that is HB 210. I'm going to make the statement that if we do pass this legislation and the voters approve it, that I believe it will be the most significant thing we do this session. I'm serious about that, and you may consider that an exaggeration. We currently bring in severance taxes. And by the way, does anyone know, anyone want to tell me what a severance tax is? I assume there may be some that don't know what it is. When we take natural resources out of the ground, we sever them from the ground. We only have one chance to do that, and when we do it, we call it a severance tax, we can tax it. Once that resource has been removed, we never tax that again as a severance tax. And all of the resources that we levy severance taxes on, oil, gas, and minerals, are non-renewable resources. They are resources that will run out at some point in the future. So you can argue about how long that is, but in 100 years, 150 years, 200 years, maybe even 50 years, that revenue stream will change. Currently, we spend every dollar in severance taxes in our general fund. On paper, we spend more than the amount of severance taxes. Last year, for example, we authorized $77 million of oil and gas severance taxes to go into the general fund, and we didn't even get that much in 2012. By the time 2012 is done, we will have received in the state coffers something around close to $70 million. So we actually spent $7 million we didn't even have. In 1998, voters created the State Permanent Trust Fund, and it was created as a repository for tobacco settlement money, which clearly was also one-time money. We didn't want to spend it all at once, and the earnings of that are used for ongoing programs. In 2008, the voters approved another constitutional amendment that provided that severance taxes, beyond the amount being spent by the legislature at the time, that severance taxes would go into the permanent trust fund for future generations. The challenge is, the structure of the fund is this. It takes a three-quarter vote of the House and the Senate to spend any money out of that fund and the signature of the governor. That's a fairly high threshold. It's only been done once. It was done in a time of severe economic need. That takes much more political will than to spend money out of the rainy day fund. And that's the intent of the permanent state trust fund, that it be a more permanent, a fund for more serious emergencies. I called it in one newspaper the tornado, hurricane, earthquake fund. More serious than just a rainy day fund. It should only be used in the most dire circumstances. We did take $40 million out in the early part, shortly after about the time at the Olympics, after the Olympics, after there was a downturn. We haven't paid that back. The legislature discovered immediately after the passage, and maybe we knew this before, but after the passage of the constitutional amendment in 2008, that by majority vote we could divert money before it got into the fund, as much as we wanted to. So if it gets in the fund, it takes three-quarters, a super majority, a very large super majority to take money out. But if we catch it before it goes in, simple majority vote, we spend it, and that's what we did last year. We increased the amount by $6 million more, to $77 million of oil and gas revenue, for example. And we mustered 34 votes in the House against that. Not quite enough to stop it. If it had been a three-quarter threshold, we would have stopped it. I think the fundamental question in all of this is, when we take all of the severance tax money and we spend it today for today's needs, even though I believe severance taxes are one-time money, not ongoing, when we spend all of it today, it won't be there tomorrow. So the question has to be, are our needs today more urgent and more important than the needs of future generations? Do we spend today what our grandchildren won't have to spend? It is a little bit like, as times begin to improve, maybe we haven't been funding our defined benefit pension plan, which most of us have these days, or 401k or something like that. If we take money out of our pocket today, we won't have it today, but we'll have it in the future. If we don't take it out, if we spend it all today, it won't be there for the future. And that is the fundamental question. Are we willing, with our severance taxes, that one-time revenue stream, to plan for the future like that Pacific island of Kiribati and have something left over when that resource and those resources are exhausted? Because I believe one day our grandchildren will ask us why we spent it all. Thank you. And I'll take questions if there are any.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Jim. Sure. Our next speaker will be Senator Wayne Niederhauser, who is going to be spending the next couple of sessions updating and modernizing the state's procurement code.
Thank you, Royce. It's always a pleasure to be here at the Taxpayers Association pre-session conference. I think that Representative Nelson's bill is a great... We've worked on this for a couple of years and just have never gotten there on that issue where we created the threshold and then we circumvented the threshold by taking the money out before it went in. Fun things that the legislature does to balance budgets. And so, I'd sure like to see this going forward because these are really one-time monies. I'm just glad that we don't have to rely upon bird droppings for that severance tax. We can get it from oil and gas and that type of severance. Procurement code, big issue for the state of Utah. We haven't really, it's been updated along the way for certain specific issues, but we've never made a wholesale change of the procurement code since it was modified for the 1979 American Bar Association procurement code. The latest Bar Association code is the year 2000, and we're adopting much of that model language in procurement in this bill and bills to come for the next couple of years. It's going to probably take 2 or 3 years to address procurement. Because it is a big issue. So, with every legislation, when we go to modify existing code, there's always cleanup, standardization, consolidation. A lot of the bill will do that, trying to create definitions across the board where we don't have to define things multiple times. And so you'll see a lot of that in this bill, just cleanup and consolidation. And that's good because it makes it easier to read. And over, you know, a 20-year period, with little changes in the code, it makes a big mess of the statute. And that's a big part of what we're doing in this year's step for procurement. The things that we will be addressing in this year's bill is adopting the 2000 model code governing invitations for bid, competitive sealed proposals. We're not adopting it exactly, but we're working on best practices that fit Utah and how we govern here in the state. But the overriding principles that we need to always address here is fairness, make sure that there's fairness and transparency in any procurement process that we take on. We'll also be addressing requests for information, reverse auctions, multi-step sealed bidding, small purchases and requests for quotes, approved vendor lists and order contracts, multi-year contracts, pre-qualification of bidders and offerors, award justification statement, tax compliance requirement for awarded state contracts, protest requirements, self-service procurement. We'll be eliminating things like the requirement to use alkaline paper and recycled paper. That's pretty much a standard in the industry today, and we don't need a lot of that language now in the procurement code. That's just the way the business is done. And a big part of this that hasn't been in the procurement code before, but we're proposing that this year in the procurement amendment, is to create penalties, criminal penalties, for violation of the procurement code. And I believe that this is an important element to address, because without some kind of a penalty, a lot of these things have been disregarded over the years. And when we see things in the news, government mismanaging or having a process that is creating a lot of controversy over procurement, it's because they've disregarded good basic practices for procurement. And now there'll be a little bit of teeth here for an intentional violation of the procurement code. This will be probably a three-step process. There'll be a companion bill with this that will address the appeal process. That's online today. I've authorized its language. It's now something you can go out and look at under my name. The procurement code bill is something you now can look at online. It was in committee in November. We've still been working on a couple modifications, so look for that here in the next couple of weeks. Hopefully next week we'll have a final draft final draft is the draft that passes at the end of the day, but at least one that we will debate in committee and on the floor. In the appeals process, we're actually streamlining that process and doing away with one of the boards, procurement boards. We're consolidating them, which is a good thing. I think we tend to create a lot of boards and committees that we don't need to, so a consolidation of that. Look for that in that bill that's public now. I'm happy to take any questions on it. This is a pretty complicated issue, and it's hard to address any specifics today, but I invite you to look at the bill, address any questions that you have with me. We welcome your comments, but we'd be happy to take any kind of 30,000-foot questions at this time. There is none, but let me just give a plug also. I'm a good friend and appreciate very much Jonathan Williams. You're going to be hearing from him at noon today. I serve on the task force that he's the national chair of, and you are in for a real treat. He's co-author with Stephen Moore and Dr. Art Lather, Rich States, Poor States, of which Utah ranks number one in economic prosperity going forward because of things that we do here, low regulation, low taxes, and so forth. But I just wanted to put a plug in for him. And Megan Archer, you want to stand up, Megan? Megan's here today as his assistant. And anyway, I want to just say that hang around for noon today. You'll have a real treat hearing from him. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll tell you a little bit more about the event between noon and one with Alec as we close today. We're next going to hear from Senator Stuart Adams talking about some energy tax incentives that he's putting together.
Thank you. Again, good to be here. I would just to reiterate what Senator Niederhauser just told you, that Jonathan is nationally renowned, and it'll be worth your time to stay and listen to him. In the state of Utah, we're pretty fortunate. You've probably heard budget numbers, $260, $280 million of additional revenue this year. And a lot of that comes because of good fiscal policy, but a lot of it comes because of businesses coming here. As I looked, last year we incentivized around 12,000 jobs. I looked through the list, and most of those jobs we have eBay, IM Flash, Lifetime Products, Liberty Sales. A lot of different companies have been are coming here and taking advantage of the incentives that we allow to happen because we're trying to be nationally competitive. And what we're seeing, though, is we're not seeing any energy companies in that list. And energy is basically a different product. It's a different industry. And so in order to help incentivize energy providers or energy developers to come in, we're actually moving the incentives in this bill from GOED over to the Department of Energy Development, in an effort to try to bring energy development into the state. We look at what happens in North Dakota. We see what the impetus has been from good, solid energy development. We need to do more of that within Utah. We look at our gas prices. We look at gases going from, you know, $2, $3, $4 a gallon. This is good policy, not only for national policy to be able to help maintain lower energy costs, but also for the state of Utah to drive more economic development, which we're seeing a result of as we see our budgets continue to grow and as we buck the national trend and have economic development here. And basically, that's what it does. Good questions. Good to be here. Try to get you back on schedule. Thank you.
It's surprising when you have an elected official who doesn't want to spend more time at the mic than they're actually allotted, so it's wonderful. Senator McAdams is going to be talking today about some rather innovative ideas he has on local distribution of sales taxes, and hopefully over the long term what we can do to get the school district out of the business of paying developers instead of paying teachers and educating our kids. Thanks.
I'm also the diversity speaker for today, as the sole Democrat, I think, on the agenda. Okay. Well, I'm pleased to be here. Thank you, and pleased to have a good relationship with the Utah Taxpayers Association. I want to talk about a bill I'm exploring that I think... I think we may have some stars aligned to actually do something important with the distribution of local option sales tax. So a bit of background. Local option sales tax is distributed under a current formula. The state allows municipalities to impose up to a 1% sales tax in addition to the state sales tax. That 1% option is distributed 50% based on the point of sale, where that sale happens, and then 50% is based on the location of the population. So let's take my city, Salt Lake City, and a purchase is made for $100 at Gateway. Now, we have a 1% option on that $100 purchase, so that goes to the cities. There's still the state portion and other portions of sales tax, but the local option. So $1 is collected at Gateway. That you're going to then break that in. 50 cents is going to go to Salt Lake City because that's where the purchase was made. 50 cents is going to go into a pot, and then it's going to be distributed statewide based on the population. So the population of Salt Lake City is 180,000. The statewide population is over 2 million, so we're less than 10%. I think we're about 7, 8% of the statewide population. So we'll collect, of that 50%, we'll collect back about 8% of that 50 cents. So we'll collect another 4 cents. So that's how sales tax is currently distributed. I'd say it's a rough formula. It's not necessarily a scientific formula, but it's a rough approximation to say, look, a full-time resident in the city has costs. And there's costs associated with providing ambulance, police, fire, roads for that full-time resident. Also, there's costs associated with the transient population. The cost of providing municipal services isn't just located where the person sleeps. It's also located to where they go. And so we're going to use point of sale to reflect that distribution of costs. Like I said, it's a rough formula, and I think for the most part it's fairly reflective of where the needs may fall. There are some criticisms about that, however. I look at on the extreme, I think there's Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City has is number 2 in the nation for daytime population increases. So you think Salt Lake City's population goes from, on Sunday night, 180,000 to Monday morning, a 72% increase of employees, and that doesn't include tourists and students. So our population goes from about 180,000 to 350,000. And there are costs associated with that influx. I think Salt Lake City is happy to be that capital city, but there are costs associated with that. There are roads like 6 South. It's a 6-lane road coming into the city. I think that's probably a 90% used by non-city residents and 10% by city residents. Those roads like that are expensive to maintain. Police and fire for high-rise buildings, there are costs with that. So the question has been raised, how do we... We Salt Lake City ran an analysis. We said how much, there's a perception we wanted to ascertain whether it's true or not, that because we have a place like Gateway, we actually are getting a windfall because people come from around the valley, they shop at Gateway, we get that 50 cents point of sale right off the top. So Salt Lake City's getting a windfall because of that. So what we did is we went through the city budget and calculated what Salt Lake City receives based on what Salt Lake City spends for non-residents. I live in Salt Lake City. I like to think of I live in Salt Lake City. My brother does not live in Salt Lake City, but he's a student at the U and he works in Salt Lake City. So we figured, you know, there are things that Salt Lake City spends just on me. And it's probably some of the fire suppression, other things in the residential areas, it's road in the residential areas. But we took things that Salt Lake City spends on full-time residents and part-time residents, part-time users of the city alike, and came up with a number that we spend on my brother, who comes into Salt Lake City to work and go to school. We spend about $280 per year on my brother. So then we ran the analysis, what would my brother have to spend at Gateway or at a car dealership or other places in Salt Lake City to generate $280 of point-of-sale sales tax? And he'd have to spend $56,000 to generate that point-of-sale sales tax. So our conclusion is, and there's, you know, we would generate additionally some property tax because Gateway exists, so it's a rough approximation, but our analysis is retail is not the windfall that a lot of people think it is. And sometimes I think that's a misperception of cities who chase after retail, try to land that retail development in their city because of all the sales tax it will bring, and it doesn't play out. Sometimes we're giving up tax incentives and other things to attract that strip mall, to attract that big box retailer to our city, and we land those sales taxes and then the costs that come with the population that's coming into our city, and it doesn't balance out. So there's a little bit of I think the distribution formula is a rough approximation and generally works. There's some adverse incentives in there that some have expressed concern with and that maybe we would want to address. I'm sympathetic to those concerns. I've had conversations with Representative Nielsen, who's had some ideas, Senator Stevenson and Representative Hughes. The idea that we've been discussing is to change the distribution formula so in addition to point of sale and population, there's also a component or a reward for wages. As it stands right now, cities, and you're starting to see a little bit of a revolt among cities when GOED or EDCU or others come to a city and say, hey, we're trying to attract this out-of-state employer to the city, and it's a distribution facility, it's a manufacturing facility, it's a call center. Starting to see some cities revolt to say, well, if it's a call center, that's not a lot of property tax. You're telling me you're going to bring in 1,000 employees, and you know, stars are in the eyes of GOED, but the city thinks 1,000 employees and a big warehouse that doesn't generate a lot of property tax, they're going to bring a home lunch, they're not going to live in my city, but I'm going to have to build a road out there, I'm going to have to service the road, the wear and tear on the road, I'm going to have to provide police and fire, there are going to be car accidents, all these expenses that the city's going to provide, and they get a little bit of property tax dollars and nothing else. So you're starting to see some cities revolt to say, yeah, no thanks, we prefer to have the big box retailer, and we're going to save our tax incentives for the big box retailer. We don't care that you're bringing in a thousand six-figure salaries into our city. What does that do for me? Now that is not the right approach that the state of Utah wants. That's not the right approach that the people of our communities want. We want to bring in these high-paying jobs that will have on a long-term benefit for our community. So we need to. I support this notion that we're going to introduce some component of a wage distribution for sales tax. Now, wages is tricky because under the Utah Constitution, income tax is dedicated purely to public education and higher education. So it can't be an income tax. But the idea that we've come up with, and I have to give credit to Representative Nielsen, Stevenson, and Hughes, was they're pushing for, we find out how wages are distributed throughout the state, and then we award a portion of sales tax based on wages in a community. So it's a sales tax distribution, but the formula has a component of wages. Now that idea has been met with resistance from many of the cities throughout the state because there is a bit of a stalemate over this 50% point of sale, 50% population, and people worry about if you introduce wages, you're going to immediately create significant winners and significant losers, and you risk provoking a civil war among cities. So the response from cities has been, you know, to Senator Stevenson and Representative Hughes and Representative Nielsen, is you raise some good points, you've got some good ideas, but we cannot go there unless there is new revenue on the table. Cities feel, and rightly so, that as healthcare costs and other salaries and other costs come into play, cities don't feel that their budgets are on a sustainable track, and there may be need for reexamining how it's distributed. So that's kind of where this bill has come. Okay, and I need to wrap it up. So the punchline is, what I saw was a at the federal level, there's the Marketplace Fairness Act looking to improve collections of online sales tax. There's Amazon is behind this effort. State of California, there's sponsorship from Republicans and Democrats to require online retailers to collect sales tax. Now, I'm not opining as to whether that's good or not, but what I'm saying is if it's going to happen and if the federal government's going to require collection of online sales tax, then what I want to see is to not lose an opportunity to change our distribution formula. What they predict is we'll see a bump of 5 to 10% in sales tax collections. We're already required to pay it. Many people don't report it on their taxes. So we'd see an improvement in collections. And what I'd like to see is to use that improvement in collections. It's going to be decided at the federal level. It's not something in the purview of the Utah legislature. But let's have legislation in place that says if that federal legislation passes, then we trigger this new distribution formula that includes wages in the distribution formula. So that's what I'm looking at, and appreciate your feedback.
Thank you.
Our next presenter will be actually a neighbor of mine, Senator Mark Mattson, and he informs me that what we had planned on having him talk about is something that got wrapped up this morning, which is actually wonderful news and also an indication of what sometimes it can cost the state when you take as long as it did this year. Senator Mattson.
It's great to be here and spend a couple of minutes with you folks and with the Taxpayer Association. This is an interesting situation for me because I've been working on an issue for probably 3 years now and received a text message this morning at 5:35 saying that it has apparently been resolved. So it's a great day, but it's also a little disconcerting in that I now have to make a presentation that is largely moot. But for several years, I think if we counted back, it'd be 3 years. I've been trying to help the largest independent movie studio in the world is Raleigh Studios, and they had come to Utah. They have studios all over, literally all over the world. I think the most recent that they built was in Budapest, but they also have one in Detroit. They have them in the Orient, and they have them obviously. They have at least two, I think I visited two, they might have three large locations in Hollywood. They had wanted to come to Utah. Utah has a long history of successful movie making here. We have a great local support industry that is available for the movie industry when it comes to Utah. So it was a natural to want to have a studio here. Raleigh came to Utah, identified the location that they wanted to build their studios, and found a parcel of land, a landowner that was willing to make the land available for the project. They came to the state, and they were not looking for any kind of subsidy. They didn't want any tax incentives. They didn't want any tax breaks. They didn't want any TIF funding. They didn't want to take money away from the school districts. They didn't want to do any of those things. They started working through the process, and then they came back to the state and said, the one thing we need, the one bit of relief that we need is a little bit of help with a very draconian local land use authority that was essentially allowing them to build only on roughly 1/6 of the land that they had acquired for this project, and saying that the rest of the land had to be kept open space, which is a very expensive and difficult proposition to deal with when you're building a commercial project. So over the years, I have tried to help deal with that, and in the legislature, the way that our government is structured in this state, the people are the sovereigns, and they delegate a little bit of authority up to the state, and then the state delegates that authority a little bit further back to local governments and municipalities and counties to empower the local governments to perform certain functions at the local level. Some people say, well, that's local control. We can delegate that authority down the line, and then we can turn our backs, and it doesn't matter if the local government turns into an absolute tyrant. Well, it's local tyrant, so we'll turn our backs on it, and we're not going to hold ourselves as a legislature accountable for the authority that we have delegated down the line. I happen to disagree with that. I think if you can delegate authority, but you can't delegate responsibility. And the state has a responsibility to make sure that all of its subdivisions are not turning into tyrants. So we've been experiencing this tension over years. And so the fact that I got a text at 5:35 this morning saying it looks like we've resolved these issues, that we're going to be able, we've reached terms that are at least favorable enough to where it pencils, that's great. But the question I would leave with you is, how many movies could have been made in the 3 years that we waited and dilly-dallied? How many people could have been employed making those movies? One of the things that I wish I could get government to understand, and I've served in local and the national government, now at state level, is just the basic business principle of the time value of money. Because it's real. And if people that are working within government don't acknowledge and understand it, they're doing a great disservice to the people they're supposed to be serving. I'm seeing the signal, I'm supposed to wrap up. But I am happy to report that it looks like we'll have a movie studio going up in Park City. Within they're supposed to start moving dirt within 90 days, so that should be exciting. Thanks.
Thank you. Property taxes are the tax everyone loves to hate, and small businesses probably love to hate personal property taxes more than any other, because in addition to paying money, you have to pay employees to put all of that together. The interim committee has taken a lot of time to look at that, and Representative Painter is here to talk about what the legislature is going to do with that this year.
Royce, thanks for inviting me here. It's a pleasure to be here. We looked at personal property tax this year in Revenue Tax Interim Committee, and what we're going to do, we'll hear the bill next Monday, hopefully. What we have now for an exemption for personal property is $3,800. My proposal, House Bill 41, will take that exemption to $25,000, from $3,800 to $25,000. It will be across the board, big or small, individual, local, or centrally assessed. It's not going to matter. We're going to take that first $25,000 and chop that off and make that exempt. We feel like there'll be thousands of people affected in a positive way with this bill. I remember once when Pam Hendrickson was the chair of the Tax Commission, and she mentioned to me when she was county assessor that she had to go in and assess the piano in the lady's house that was teaching piano lessons. And so what I'm going to try and do is say thanks to the small business owner that likely doesn't have over that amount. And what it will do for him, not only will it cut his property tax, but as far as the property tax audits that go on, if you're underneath that threshold, we think likely and most probably those folks will not have to encounter the property tax audit that goes with that, which is time consuming. Takes a lot of time out of a businessman's working day to come up with depreciation schedules and all this and do the whole survey in his place of business. Will be likely it will get rid of a lot of that. I mean, the Tax Commission has information based on a taxpayer's filing of his fixed assets and his personal property and the depreciation. And so they'll be able to, if they can tell fairly quickly that he's clearly underneath that. That's not to say they won't maybe pull an audit and still audit a few of them, but the likelihood after they do a bunch of them and see, look, this isn't going to raise one ounce of revenue, and we've spent time auditing and come up with nothing. Hopefully we get rid of that friction cost to the small business owner. The way property taxes are structured, businesses pay full retail on property tax. They're real estate. They get no exemption of 45% like a homeowner does. Their personal property is the same way. We want to structure this and take a whole bunch of folks off of that tax roll and make it easier for the small business guy who we should be thanking that creates the jobs in our state and in this country. Make life easier for him. That's the least we can do for him. They've hung in there through these hard times, and that's our way of saying thanks to them. So we'll be hearing this bill next week. it'll be on the committee. It was going to go to the board, but we may have one slight amendment to it. But it'll be there. We'll hear it, and then I'm planning on going forward with that. So that's what it does, and we want to keep our business-friendly attitude here in the state, and this is one more way to do that. Sure.
Is there something in the bill to prevent the counties from increasing their mill rate to eliminate the offset for the exemption?
The way the bill is drafted right now, it will, in truth of taxation, it'll shift. So there'll be a, it'll be a slight increase on, well, if you take a look at a business owner that has personal property at his place, of course he's got real estate at his place of business, he might see a little tick up in the valuation there and in the tax take. A homeowner might see $2 or $3 depending on the county. But what we do is what I'm trying to do is eliminate that friction cost and the time that it takes these folks to go through this audit that really doesn't raise a whole lot of revenue for the state or the county. So that's the goal, first of all. I want to make it easy to do business here. So that's my goal. Any other questions? Thank you for having me. Thanks, Royce.
Appreciate it.
You bet.
I'm sure many of you were anxious to hear from Senator Bramble, who is the chair of Senate Revenue Tax. He is on a plane currently, and we had pre-recorded something for him. Given the time, we're just going to be putting that on our webpage, and you'll be able to see about the discussion on travel-related resellers. And we will go to David Crapo, who will talk to us about SB 27, Taxpayers' Right to a Refund.
Thank you very much. How many of you think a taxpayer should be able to get a refund of sales tax that's been erroneously collected? Okay, this bill should go through. What happened this last year in September, the Supreme Court issued a decision where a taxpayer had asked for a refund of sales tax. The Supreme Court indicated in that decision, well, we don't believe the taxpayer is entitled to ask for the refund directly unless the commission has made the mistake or has erroneously made the mistake. In this situation, a taxpayer had paid the tax to the vendor. The vendor had made the mistake and had inappropriately collected the tax and then had remitted the tax to the commission. The taxpayer then went and said, we'd like to get our tax money back that was erroneously collected. The vendor said, we've already remitted it to the commission. Go ask the commission. So an action was filed with the commission. Commission said no. Supreme Court said taxpayers in the state, because the way the statute is written, cannot directly ask for a refund if the commission does not make a mistake. In this case, the vendor made the mistake. It was not the commission. Therefore, no refund to the taxpayer. So what this bill does is amend the refund provision in Utah law to say that if the tax is erroneously collected, whether it's the commission that made a mistake, the taxpayer that made a mistake, the vendor made the mistake, the taxpayer still has the right to get the refund. That's point one. Point two in the bill, when the Supreme Court issued their decision, they said, we look at imposition provisions in this state when you impose a tax, and if they're ambiguous, we interpret them in favor of the taxpayer. If there's an exemption against a tax, we look in favor of the state. Well, in this particular case, they looked at it and said, this is a refund. Well, we don't know quite how to handle that. We'll say we'll interpret this in favor of the state. Now, that doesn't make sense. A refund is merely an imposition provision for money that's been imposed and collected improperly and held by the state. So point number two of the bill is to put back the standard the way it was before. Whether you're seeking to stop paying a tax that shouldn't be paid or getting a refund from a tax that shouldn't get paid, the burden is on the state to establish that, and it's interpreted in favor of the taxpayers. So that's the second point. The third point that is in the bill, in Senate Bill 27, is what type of evidence can a taxpayer put in to show that the tax was erroneously collected? And we're basically putting in the bill codification of Rule 4 that was previously adopted by the Commission and has been in place for a number of years that says you can amend the old invoice and make a new invoice if you can justify it based on the historical books and records that were available at the time of the transaction. So we think that's an appropriate codification into the bill. The last thing the bill does is it's retroactive in nature. And the reason that it is asking to be applied retroactively is since the decision came out from the Supreme Court on September 27th, the State Tax Commission has held or has stopped remitting any refund claims in the state of Utah on sales tax for individual taxpayers, what they call third-party taxpayer claims. And thus, the State Tax Commission is now holding, some would say hostage, $6.7 million of refund claims from the citizens of this state. If we don't make it retroactive, there's a chance that that $6.7 million in claims that taxpayers have made in good faith would disappear, because when they file again after this bill passes, they'll say, oh, three-year statute of limitations may have passed for some of you. So the bill is basically to put us back to the status quo, make it clear, and reestablish the taxpayers' rights for sales tax. We hope it goes through, and we hope it votes, just like you did, that taxpayers should be able to get a refund. Are there any questions? Max?
Yeah. Is there opposition to this?
I hope not. Of course, there may...
Besides the Supremes.
Well, there's five. No, three, because there's a 3-2 vote. Not that I'm aware of. The one concern that we would have is whether there'll be a fiscal note attached to it, because there's always concern for monetary issues in the state. We understand that. We don't believe there should be a fiscal note, because we believe it's just taking it back to the status quo, and that already has been accounted for in the prior legislation to set the tax base where it is. But if there is a fiscal note, we'll have to look at that. But we're waiting to see what the final decision is. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Well, it appears that the Taxpayers Association's conference does take second billing to a meeting with Speaker Lockhart. I know that our last speaker wasn't able to join us because he is over there. And so we're going to call that good for today. As Senator Niederhauser indicated earlier, the Taxpayers Association, in about 15 minutes over in the Capitol Boardroom, will be holding a news conference where Jonathan Williams and Megan Archer will be joined by the Governor, the Speaker, and the Senate President. Senator Niederhauser also noted that Utah, in the latest version of the Alec Report, Rich States, Poor States, was ranked first in the nation.